There's another side to good health, and that's good mental health.
I've listened to a few of you guys got the stamp of approval from my friend Lisa.
Oh, Lisa Cornwell.
So I worked with her for half dozen years or so, Golf Channel. We're good friends. So, got the recommendation from them, and then I listened to a few others. And you guys do great. You guys do a great job.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Where are you based, Justin?
I'm just outside of Dallas.
So you're in the hub. You're right in the heartbeat of golf country.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here. You know, there's a pretty good golf community, some good courses, and the tour's here for about a month every year. So there's a LPGA event right down the road for me too. It's a good spot to be if you want to be in this industry. And I go to London like a few times a year, and I can go direct from DFW, which is as you get older and you get sick of, a little more sick of traveling after all the time I've spent on the road, that's a nice perk.
I imagine that's for the 21st group.
Yeah, that's where our headquarters are at. Are in London. We're kind of spread out all over the world. We work in a lot of different sports. I'm the public face of the golf business, pretty much, in terms that I work with a lot of media partners. But we do a lot of stuff behind the scenes, whether that's providing technology solutions for golf companies. About a larger percentage of our business is based in international soccer. So I've got a lot of we've got people in London, in Paris, in Singapore, in San Francisco. I'm in Texas. I have an associate in Florida. And we're all kind of, whether it's behind the scenes working with front offices or like my arm of it, which is like I work with Sky Sports 20 weeks a year on their broadcast. And, you know, I write for a whole bunch of different places. And we've got our arms in a lot of different things. It's a really cool business to be part of because we've got a lot of different diverse opportunities and things that we're into. And still at my core, I get to be part of the sport that I really love and love being a part of and love covering.
You might be the most alert person in golf. Whenever I look at your Twitter feed on a Sunday, it takes my breath away. It's kind of like witnessing Russell Crowe a la A Beautiful Mind. It's this like beautiful psychotic dance of statistics and findings and projections and predictions. I have to know what the Justin Ray Command Center looks like on golf tournament days, because it's got to be a madhouse.
I appreciate that. I take that as a very nice compliment to call it a manic statistical dance. So I've got in my office, I've got two TVs in front of me. I've got a primary computer and then an extra screen. And then I'm talking to you guys on my older computer that I use for because I find it easier if I'm having a conversation and I'm doing a hit or something like that with radio or TV or whatever. If I need to look up an answer real quick, I've got my other computer to find it. But it's a weird way to talk about it. I mean, I've been doing this. I started in the ESPN research department in 2007. I was still in college. I had an internship with them. And like right away, you learn, first of all, you're with a bunch of people who are insane about sports like me. And, you know, grew up, you know, I was the kid who grew up, you know, tracking his baseball stats in Microsoft Excel on his dad's computer. Like, you know, who was more fascinated with the back of the baseball card than the front, right? Like, you know, that's been my whole, you know, life and what I've been interested in. And first of all, you're around all those different people, but you realize there's a way when you're in sports TV production to watch a sport where you're being anticipatory of what's coming next because you want to come up with something interesting to do your job, to supplement the broadcast to make it more interesting for fans. So it's fun as I've welcomed in some people and try to show them the ropes to see that light kind of go off after a little while where it's not reactive, it's proactive. Because if you're in a live, you know, broadcast of a golf tournament or a basketball game or whatever it is, you need to have stuff ready to go before it actually happens so you can put it on screen in that moment or the announcer can say it in that moment. So I've built up my resources over the years and I've gotten to a point where I'm pretty fast at getting to stuff. It's kind of a way to think about the sport and see things before they happen and try to anticipate things that would be interesting that, you know, supplement the whole experience for fans.
Yeah. And I guess for those who might not be familiar with you or who haven't stumbled into that statistical spider's web of your Twitter feed, can you, I guess, at a high level, explain sort of what your day-to-day looks like?
So my title is head of content for 21st Group. And, you know, I work, like I said, for about 20 weeks a year for all the big events. I'm the person behind the scenes providing information and graphics and answering questions for the folks on Sky Sports. That's kind of like what I did for Golf Channel for 7 years and then ESPN for 5 years before that. But I was working at ESPN. I did all sports. I worked on SportsCenter. I worked on the Scott Van Pelt Show. And then Golf Channel obviously is just golf. So I decided to make that my focus when I went to Golf Channel full time. But I work with them on the broadcast. I generate content before the events start. So they've got something to base off, you know, like a graphic that pops up when, you know, Rory's walking down the fairway and talks about his success at this venue or something. I'm just making something up. But there's a preparation factor that goes into it. And then during the tournament, I'll do the same thing where it's kind of like my Twitter feed on steroids is kind of what their Slack channel is with Sky Sports. So they'll have a lot more than I just put out to the public. I also write a lot. I write for the PGAtour.com every week. I write for The Athletic during the big events, kind of taking a statistical analytical look at whether it's previewing a tournament or having quick reactions to some of those numbers that you talked about. My company is also behind the KPMG Performance Insights on the LPGA Tour, which is really fascinating. That's been a really rewarding experience work-wise to really provide and generate stuff for the women's game that was never there before. That's been a really rewarding thing. So we're behind that, and I work with that day in and day out. I'm working with Captain Lewis and the U.S. Solheim Cup team this year, which is really interesting stuff. My company in the past has consulted Team Europe and the International President's Cup team on some course strategy and pairing strategy. So it's good to be with Team USA again, something that we hadn't done in the past. I can keep going. We have a lot. I mean, our hands are in a lot of different stuff. We work with different manufacturers.
I know. It's crazy.
Help them with their content, help them supplement what they're doing in real time to tell interesting stories about the players they sponsor. I work with TaylorMade. I work with the USGA in the past. So we kind of got our hands all over the sport. Yeah. And, you know, I just kind of able, I won't say farm myself out for different causes, but our business has got this kind of multi-pronged, you know, the octopus arms are in a whole bunch of different stuff, right? So you're not from a business standpoint, I thought that was I really liked the idea of what the company was when I joined it, because in TV, you're like, if I work for Network X, I'm totally reliant on that deal being renewed, right? By those rights deals being renewed for whether it's CBS or NBC or ESPN. Mm-hmm. And if you can diversify where you are in the sport, you're not completely beholden to one set of circumstances guaranteeing what you're going to be moving for. So that's the kind of the approach I took. So that was a really way too long answer to your question, but hopefully that makes some sense.
Well, it just shows how much work you are doing. And like you said, the octopus tentacles, it's more like I don't know what the Greek prefix is for 10, but it's whatever, however many arms that is, you're reaching a lot of different pieces of pies, which is very cool.
And ultimately, I'm just watching golf and looking stuff up and come up with things I find interesting. So,
without giving away any state secrets, what is, like, let's take the Team USA and Captain Lewis use case, for example. What are you arming her and them with so that they can come out to the Solheim Cup and compete and deliver a result?
So the thing I emphasize when I talk to the players and talk to Captain Lewis, the assistant captains, is that, you know, this is a tool in her toolbox to try to get put the players in the best position possible to succeed, right? You're not going to win the Solheim Cup or the Ryder Cup on a spreadsheet. But what you can do is you can put players together that accentuate each other's strengths and fit a golf course to its best, you know, make the best fit for a golf course. So whether that's order of tee shots, when you're playing alternate shot based on hole types and player strengths and weaknesses, or whether that's finding, you know, when we get down to the captain's picks, all right, this player, like, she might not be as high in some of the traditional rankings, but we see some really good underlying trends here that suggest that she'd be more valuable, stuff like that. So, you know, basically just we're not going to be responsible for winning the trophy, but what we can do is arm the captain and the players and put them in the best situation possible to win. So that's, without giving away too many secrets, that's kind of what we do.
We don't want that. We want them to bring home a victory. So we don't want to give anyone else a competitive advantage against. Are those conversations, like, you know, data generally is growing in sport in such a seismic way, right? Across all sport and across every type of use case. Are those conversations difficult to have ever with players or coaches who are maybe not so receptive? You know, you look at some golfers, some athletes are feel based, right? And they go exclusively off of, you know, you look at somebody like Bubba Watson, for example, who's a painter, right? He's shaping shots all over the place. A very creative person. Are there conversations that you have that you present somebody with findings with analysis of data, and those are hard conversations to have for those reasons?
Are there any people like Philip Seymour Hoffman and Moneyball, the reluctant Art Howe manager of the Oakland Athletics? Yeah. No, look, it's a lot easier than it was, say, 10, 15 years ago. I remember working at the Masters with ESPN in 2011, and I tried to get strokes gained putting into a graphic, like in a little SportsCenter preview segment, and you would have thought I put something in Mandarin on the screen. Like, they were like, what? Get this off the television. Like, we are not doing this. So to come from that to what it's evolved into more than a decade later, where it's, you know, the advanced numbers and stuff, like you said, it's like this way in all sports, where we're more, you just need to hear it and be more familiar with it to be more comfortable with it, right? And look, some players find it really beneficial. You know, Matt Fitzpatrick's a really famous example of that, obviously. Like, he, you know, our team worked with him in years past. He's a guy who's really analytical and, you know, famously tracks all the shots and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And some people just want, you know, you got to have kind of a different hand in terms of how heavy you are with it, right? You might, like, we might find something in a player's that might help their practice routine. Be like, hey, you know, from 50 to 125 yards, you're not nearly as good as you were 2 years ago, right? Like, maybe you should work a little bit more on that. Whereas that might be more helpful to somebody than just giving them, okay, here's reams and reams of data. Like, and there's a lot of parallels to that to working in sports TV. Not every analyst and anchor and, you know, person who's calling a game or a tournament has the same needs and same responses to information. But if I'm able to, like someone like Nick Daugherty loves all the information. He's an analyst on Sky Sports. Great guy to work with. And he loves all the data he can get. He wants all the information he can get. But somebody who might be a little more traditional, if you give them one note and it really catches their eye, it might not be the most detailed thing in the world, but they find great value in that, as opposed to, you know, somebody who wants every piece of information you can have. Like, I worked a lot with Brandel over the years in Golf Channel, and he wants, you know, I'm trying to beat him in terms of coming up with digging up numbers, right? When I'm working with him, the approach is different for different people. And there's a, like I said, there's parallels to that when you work with players, work with teams, whatever that might be. You've got to, it's my job as, you know, the person who's coming up with the information. I find the delivery to be just as important as the data itself, because if you don't transmit it in the right way, whether that's the timing of your tweet or the way you write it in an article or the way you give it to an analyst or anchor, or in this case, the way I give it to the Solheim Cup captain or an assistant captain or a player, it's all about the delivery method too.
Oh yeah. In the player example, you're delivering data that not only has to do with their work and how they earn a living, but something that they've dedicated their entire life to.
Yeah.
So if you're coming up to me and saying, you know, Mr. Drew Westfall or Mr. Lobenstein, from 125 yards in, you suck. That's an emotional conversation.
Probably won't word it that way, but yeah, no. I mean, honestly, though, too, there might be a player who reacts better to something direct like that, you know. Right. Whereas if somebody's more sensitive about it, you know, it's all part of the process. It's all part of learning. You know, you got to learn the people too, and I think that's a really key part of like what I've done throughout my career in TV, and now what I do now. That I think, you know, you got to understand who you're working with and be able to, you know, gauge what is going to be the best method of delivering something to somebody.
So you're an orator and a rhetorician just as much as you are a statistician, which is
my background's in journalism. I mean, I kind of fell backwards into the golf data. Like, I always get pinned as that, but to me, the statistics are storytelling, right? Like, it's you're explaining what's going on. Now, it's a really defined mathematical way of a lot of numbers describe what's going on, but like, I have, you know, folks I've worked with in my company and who have since left the company, they have really big data science backgrounds and stuff. I went to journalism school, man. Like, my advanced data tools are like Microsoft Excel and a TI-30 calculator. Like, it ain't that complicated. This is still dudes chasing a ball around a field. Like, it's not rocket science. Yeah. So, I think as part of the storytelling process, the delivery and the oration of it is just as important. You got to have accurate information, obviously, but it's just as important as the data itself.
Yeah, I know, like, I personally, when we're talking about like the amateur game, you know, you're obviously you're working a lot on the professional side of things, but you know, we're here talking about My TaylorMade Plus a little bit, and when I open the My TaylorMade Plus app and I'm looking at the content, and I'm certainly looking at like the data of how I have performed over the last weeks, months, year, I get a little overwhelmed by data, if I'm honest. And I think for amateurs, there's a balance of, you know, how much information is too much information when we're working in a game like golf, right? Little tweaks here and there, you know, 1 millimeter, 1 club face angled twist is the difference between a good shot and a bad shot. And I'm curious from your perspective on the amateur side, you know, if I were to look at my data in the My TaylorMade Plus app, what is the absolute essential data to be reviewing that I should be looking at, that I should be paying attention to?
For me, it's finding the ways that you can make yourself better. Whether that's pinning down how far you hit each iron, which a lot of people, even really some good amateurs, don't have. People are more dialed in now than they were in the past with, you know, launch monitors and stuff being more affordable and easier to use. But I think anything you can find within that data to make you better, right? And make you enjoy the game more, right? You know, if you find out, if you've got information telling you like, man, I'm terrible on par threes. Why is this? Well, I mean, like you played them and let's say you went out and you shot 78, but you were 5 over on the par threes or something like that. What was the common thread in those shots and what's something that you need to work on? It's like, okay, well, 150 to 175, I'm all over the place. Like I'm an accurate driver. When I've got a wedge in my hand, I'm pretty good. I'm all right around the greens, but maybe I need to focus my practice on when I go out in the range, I'm going to hit 70% of my shots are going to be 150 to 175 because that's what I need to work on the most. And maybe that's the thing you extract from the information that you can use to make yourself better and make you enjoy the game more. That's the big thing for me. People, I think their initial hurdle when they approach sports data or information, it's just the initial fear of it and the overwhelming sense of, oh my God, look at all this. Like, you know, nobody wants, that's the thing for, it goes back to what I said about knowing how to deliver something to somebody, right? You don't need, most people don't need 10 million lines of information on a spreadsheet, right? But if you can get that boiled down into what the important information is, and you can use it to help yourself become a better player, get better, make a few birdies, beat your buddy, you know, win your match, whatever it might be, that's what it's all about, right? So for me, when it comes to the amateur game, it's finding something within your practice or within your strategy or whatever it might be that might make you better.
Drew, what do you think that is for you? Where do you need to improve?
I think I need to improve my putting, but you saw that firsthand when we were out in Ramtail. But I do like
the... I don't know, dude. Like, literally the first putt I ever saw you hit was an eagle putt from off the green on a par five, and you
made
it.
That is true. It was using a different putter, though, so that was...
Okay, there we go.
Yeah, I need a new putter.
Blame the wand.
Problem. Yeah.
That's a strong first impression.
Yeah, it was. It really was. I was like, that was a birdie. They're like, no, it was a par. It was par five. So Connor and Bradford and I all played D3 golf. So we played golf at a good level, but not the most elite for amateurs.
Yeah, but for you're myself, better than I've ever been.
I fancy myself as more of a field player, and I just recently got fitted for clubs and dialing in all the numbers. I do like the sense of how you can use the My TaylorMade Plus app to find your weaknesses, because I think that in amateur golf, a lot of times people are afraid or unwilling to look in the mirror sometimes at what they're bad at. Yeah. You know, they want to go out and practice driver when really it could be, you know, 125 or 100 yards and in is what they actually need to work on. And golf really can be a vanity sport at times. And I think that if you are using these tools that we have correctly, then you just have to trust that the data that you're getting is correct and can actually help benefit you.
For sure. Like if you talk about the vanity of it, like you really hit it 280 every time, buddy. Do you really like dad of two who plays once a month? Like,
that's true.
I don't think you're going to be able to carry that water.
You got Drew's bio.
Knowing
what your strong points are, what your skill, what your limitations are, it can help you with your decision making. And, you know, ultimately like if you rinse it, you're going to lose that hole to your buddy and your $5 or whatever. But if you mm-hmm. know that, okay, if I'm going to position, I'm going to hit a 5-iron or 6-iron right of the hazard and then hit wedge and make par and challenge him to make, you know, I don't know, just whatever that might, whatever that, those pieces of information might be to help you make better decisions and help you enjoy the game, then, you know, take that for what it's worth. And you can do it at different levels too, right? Some people might want all the detailed information they can get, and some people might find, you know, a little bit less and a more, you know, concise delivery of it more helpful. And I think my TaylorMade Plus is really good about that.
That self-awareness, mm-hmm. man, that vanity. I mean, that's what we harp on constantly with the mental side too, with just mental health in general, right? Is understanding your patterns and behaviors in certain situations and working and exposing those and working on those to get better and more comfortable. And I think, yeah, that's the same logic should apply to your golf game if that's the avenue that you're interested in. Justin, you said you grew up a huge sports fan, but I'm curious where your penchant for research developed, and, you know, why the interest in the back of the baseball card as opposed to the front of it.
It's a good question. The source of being interested in that, I'm not sure if I can totally tell you. Sports have been like my entire focal point of my interest in my life since I was a little kid. Like I've been an absolute sports nut, consuming it, watching it, playing it when I was younger. And that's across the board. Like my dad has worked for PGA of America for more than 30 years. So golf was in my family. He played at Oklahoma. He was a Texas state champion in high school. And so golf's always been part of it. But like I grew up in, you know, I played basketball. I played baseball was my sport through high school. That was what I was more into. You know, football until I decided that, you know, being a big guy, running into someone and just like falling over, getting stepped on, wasn't my idea of a great time. I much preferred to throw a ball really hard. So that's why I went with baseball. But yeah, I played and was into everything, and I've just never stopped, you know. Like I've always, you know, if you want to be a researcher at ESPN, you're either a total gambling addict or you're a crazy person. I was the latter, crazy person who would just, you know, my calendar and schedule revolved around whatever games were on that night. And like, you know, every project I ever did growing up in school was about, you know, an athlete or a sporting event or whatever. It's just always been ingrained in who I am and what I do. And I guess wanting to always learn more and do more about it, that kind of fueled that love for learning more information and numbers and stats and storytelling. But coupling it all together, the other thing I really loved, and I didn't realize this till I got to ESPN, was the cohesive team aspect of live television. When we're as kids growing up, when you're on teams, you know, like a baseball team, basketball team, whatever, it's just part of kind of like your day-to-day life. If you're really into sports, you leave high school, go to college, don't play sports anymore, you're really on your own a lot. There's not a lot of things where you can work together as a team to achieve a common goal. And that's a really cool thing to be a part of. And I always looked at making a show or live broadcast or whatever, we're all on the same team. The producer, the director, the analyst, we're all members of the team. Like, you know, I might be the backup strong safety as a production assistant who's cutting one highlight throughout the whole thing, but I've got a critical role. I've got to execute or else the rest of the team looks bad and we don't win. And I don't know, maybe it's a little bit romantic and kind of silly to think of it that way, but I always got a lot of joy out of working together as a team and a unit, and live TV production was a really great way to kind of bring all those things together.
High pressure environment too. You have to execute.
It's fun. I love it. That's the thing I miss the most. Like I don't work in TV every single day now, as I do all kinds of other stuff too, but that's the thing I loved about it. Like live TV when, okay, Brooks Koepka just shot 65 on Saturday. He just putts rolls in. I'm pounding out a graphic. It's going to go on the air in 20 seconds. I've got to deliver it, the information concisely, accurately, get it to the graphics producer person, give the information to the, like all the different things piecing into it. And there's a clock. Like in live TV, I always love when they say, we got 30 back. Like that's what they'll say in the break with the stage manager. That 30 seconds, that's a week in television. Like you've got, oh, I've got all the time in the world to do that. So that's the thing I loved, was the being under the pump, being like under pressure to get stuff done. I love that part of it. And I kind of miss being part of that every day, working in TV every day, but I still get a good dose of it working with Sky. So it satiates me a little bit. I wish I had a little bit more of it, but it's a really fun aspect of it.
I really like the range that you've been able to show us and in your professional life for all the kids that are out there that are the ones looking on the back of the card instead of the front. That I think a lot of times people, they dream of either being a professional athlete or working in sports. You know, those are the dreams as kids that we have. And nowadays, it seems like with technology, there are just a plethora of new opportunities, and the opportunities that like your kid and my two children will have, their jobs aren't even created at this point.
They don't exist,
which
yet.
Is like, yeah, they don't exist, which is kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah, like I can't. I mean, I'm almost 40 now. But I was born in 84, and to think like my job did not exist, and I mean, maybe in a really smaller level. I know there's some like. If you remember, Stump the Schwab, the sports trivia show on ESPN?
It's a great
like,
show.
Howie Schwab is like one of the original ESPN researchers, right?
Yeah.
But like even his career like wouldn't begin till years after that. So think about my son who's two. Like, who knows what it looks like in 2030, right? Or when he's an adult. So
yeah.
2050 or whatever when he's an adult.
Yeah.
2030 is a few years from now. What am I thinking about?
They got to renew my license by then. Yeah.
But don't get me wrong. Like when I was 12 years old, I was going to win the U.S. Open and the Cy Young Award in the same year. So, I mean, that was what was in my head. So, but you know, you grow up and you realize like, okay, if I want to be part of this, whether it's sports TV or the data analytics side or both of it or work for an organization, work for a team, be a coach, like there's so many different ways you can go where you can fulfill that. It's not a childhood joy. It's a lifelong joy that you get from being part of sports. And you can fulfill that and still, you know, make a living. So there's a lot of other things to do that when you wash out at age 18 and realize there's not many scholarship offers for a right-hander who tops out at 80 miles an hour, and then you've got to find a new thing in your life that, you know, you can find that avenue for yourself.
You talk about Stump the Schwab, which was, it's a great reference. Yeah. I mean, I haven't thought of that show in a long time, but like that show, the future of that show, the next iteration of that show would be like Stump the AI, and that doesn't work. So I'm curious what you think, where you think the ceiling is on data in sport. Where, how far can it go? It's practical implementation of big data leading to finding imposed on sport and performance.
Ultimately, the value from the sport itself comes from the athletes and the teams and, you know, competing against each other, winner and loser. That's that human element of it is always needs to be at the forefront as the most important part. But look, there are things that are coming in sports that we didn't think were possible 15 or 20 years ago. I think about the prospect of robotic umpires in Major League Baseball and think about like,
yo,
that's a real thing that's on the way, that's coming. And like when I was a kid, that was like Jetsons stuff. That was, you know, totally incomprehensible. But so I use that as a parallel to say, I don't know if I can possibly predict where it could go next, but I know that in order to keep people centrally interested and invested and loving it, that the actual sport itself needs to be the focal point of it. The players on the course, court, field, whatever the sport is, that still needs to be the focal point. Now, the way I use it as a storyteller, what I have the ability to do predictively now is better than we've ever had before, where I can tell you that like player X has a 30% chance to finish in the top 10 this week because of this, this, and this, or the predicted outcome of this player's round is going to be this. And there's all kinds of ways you can do that. Now there's the obvious way to monetize it through gambling, which that's a whole nother avenue that's opened up here legally in the United States in recent years. But there's a lot of valuable storytelling elements to that too. And I think that we're just beginning to see the beginnings of what that can mean moving forward. And look, it's my job to be able to take those tools and find new ways to tell really interesting stories, right? And that's what I try to do every day.
How much are you reading? What are some of your veritable sources of truth when you're doing research on the fly? And you know, you mentioned having all the computer screens, the monitors up in front of you on any given championship Sunday, but you know, you must have a dialed research engine or database that you're pulling stats from. What are some of those quick hits for you?
Yeah, so I've built a lot of them myself over the years before I joined 21st Group. I think the first big one I made at ESPN, because I kind of realized like there was all this information for baseball, NBA, and the NFL. And then you got beyond that, and those resources were kind of sparse in terms of like ways to pick things up and really tell really cool stories. So I started building them on my own. So like one of the first things I did 10, 12 years ago was make I call it a database, just a giant Excel file. And it's every men's major champion ever going back to the 1860 Open and like their position by round, how old they were, wow, country, major win. I've added strokes gained total because that's just how much you beat the field by, all that stuff. So like the example I always use is like in 2014 when Rory wins his fourth major at the age of 25, I can like click, 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 and I have the list of players with four majors, 25 and younger. And I can make that graphic and it goes on air. And Rich Lerner says it, and Brandel says something about it, and there you go. So that's what I try to come up with as many tools as possible to do that. Every year at the end of the year, you get beyond now the tour championship, you get into the fall. You've got time in this job to kind of take a step back and say, okay, how can I make this better? So I'm always trying to come up with things that I didn't have before. I made another database, which is just a big Excel sheet, of every top 10 finish ever in majors. And that's been really helpful too. And it was really helpful because it was the year before Sergio won the Masters. And I was able to tell you the players with the most top 10s in majors before they broke through with their first major win. Because that's a big storyline, obviously, for Sergio Garcia. Yeah. Yeah. And so I learned who Ed Dudley was, who apparently did it a million times and never broke through and won a major. But anyway, I'm always trying to come up with new answers to that. And in the last year or so, it's been a lot of stuff in the women's game as we've worked more for that. I've got a growing database of women's major champions that I'm trying to replicate that look just like my men's one. And then I've got an awesome intelligence engine. We call it an intelligence engine. I know it's kind of a kooky name, but the resources we have in terms of the computer science people I have in London are able to take really detailed things and sort it out. The tools we've been able to generate to where I can tell you, you know, every strokes gained category, not just what they're ranking in a season, but since any given point. So like the last 6 months, the best strokes gained approach player is X. The last 2 years, the player with the most rounds of X or better is this. And it's just different ways to piece things together and give context. So when Justin Thomas shoots 62, I can tell you it's not like it's the 10th time he shot 62 or lower. I can tell you he's got X number of 62 or lower since this, and that's twice as many as any other player. And that gives you a much more valuable piece of information than just let's count the number of 62s a guy shot. I hope that makes sense, but like it's a big collection of a bunch of different resources. It's all kind of pooled together, and you've got to kind of know where to look and where to find it in the right timing.
Well, and to your point, it's adding another layer of richness to that data. It's not just here's how many times this happened. It's here's how many times this happened since this, this, and this were also true. It's all this conditional formatting that tells a story as opposed to just spitting out numbers.
I'll give you an example. Like last year at the US Open in the final round, Matt Fitzpatrick hit 17 of 18 greens in regulation, I believe. So that in and of itself is impressive. You just say he hit 17 of 18 greens in regulation. All right, well now tell me who's hit 17 greens in the final round of a major win since X. And you get a list, and I think it was like Nick Faldo, and I think Koepka, Aaron Hills, and Fitzpatrick, and that's it for 40 years. That's way more impressive than just knowing he hit 17 of 18, right? So that's the kind of, I talked about the switch that gets flipped kind of when you're watching, when you're kind of growing in what I do as a profession. That's kind of the difference maker, right? Where you're able to take this piece of information, but you're able to give it that additional layer of context that, you know, makes it truly interesting.
And those databases that you've built, is there a way that you can put into terms how large those data sets are? Like, I don't even know how to quantify. Like how many rows, how many
so
columns?
I've got an all-time all majors strokes gained database. It's not all the way done, but I have every round ever played by everyone at the US Open, and I'll find it right now. It is 48,000 lines of data. So it's a lot,
and you're manually inputting data.
To tell you like. So I was doing some, I don't know when this is going to come out, but it's the week before the US Open. So I'm working on some prep there.
We're waiting. Yeah. So you got time.
Okay. Yeah, but I was going to say that like since World War II, the player with the most strokes gained total per round at the US Open without a win is Bobby Locke. Xander Schauffele's second. That's how good he's been in his US Open career. But that, because I have that, because I took the time to generate that, I'm able to come up with that note. And so maybe invariably, if Xander's two off the lead going into the final round or something, boom, there you go. I've got some really cool context to tell you how good he's been at the US Open.
Wow. So yeah, wow. You're building all these contingencies to be like, if Xander Schauffele is sniffing the lead or doing something special, you have a piece of data that you can share.
Yeah. That's- I might look up 10 things and use one, because you end up doing right. all these kind of circumstantial, right? And you react to what really happens in real time. So there's a lot of stuff that right. I write down on a pad and just scratch it out and go to the next one.
Mm-hmm. So like you said, though, we are quickly approaching US Open week, and we won't publish this for about another month. So you've okay. got some, cool. you know, your secret, we've signed a verbal NDA on any predictions that you might have or anything like that. What is your preparation for this week look like, knowing it's a big one for the world of golf? And what are some pieces of data that you've pulled, or some findings that you are hoping to come true that you've pulled out of your databases?
So the process is really, so I make a preview document, which is essentially like 20 to 30 pages of Microsoft Word that's graphics and stuff that could run for Sky Sports. And like, you can read it and learn stuff, or you can use it as the data that's going to go on the screen physically in and of itself too, right? So as I'm looking those things up, there's some core things that I start with. And one of the things that has become a staple in the last couple of years is, okay, winners at this tournament, and usually if it's not the US Open, it's a place where the course is consistently the same place year in and year out, right? Percentage of strokes gained for winners at this tournament compared to the tour average. So like the Phoenix Open heavily values approach play more so than the PGA Tour average, or the Honda Classic, or let's say Harbortown, strokes gained around the green is more important because players are much more likely to miss the green in regulation because the greens are tiny. Stuff like that you can extract from. But what I'll do is I'll take a couple of those core things, like best score to par in majors since X, and then I'll take, okay, this player here, I'll look something up about that. And it's kind of like this stairwell of learning more and more to where I can build and find things. And during that kind of expedition process of learning about the player and the trends, you end up building this large array of really cool information that becomes helpful. And that's the core of what spins into everything I write online, like a lot of different tweets I come up with. This happens and it reminds me of something I looked up a week ago. And then I can kind of tail off and do something that's sort of related to that. I mean, it's all kind of bubbling around in my head all the time. And then as I'm going through that building process, different outcomes spawn off of things. I hope that makes sense, but it's a real kind of organic, like sprawling out of one piece of information can turn into 100, and it had a source at some point. By the time you get to your endpoint, you don't really know where it began, but you found it and it's verified and it's accurate and it's something cool that can be, you know, additive to a fan's experience.
Well, that's actually really beautiful and says a lot about your role, that like only you can create that random meandering path to come up with some finding or some query that only you had and knew how to get there. Like, you know, you even talk about, again, we bring up like AI and use of that as a resource to like find data, but only you, it seems, could come up with that system of questions that take you from one question to one seemingly completely unrelated other question 20 steps down the line, and like only you can come up with that. So that's a really beautiful thing.
It's nice of you to say. I don't know if I'm the only one who can, but I do it more than anyone in this sport. I'll give you that. But yeah, it's an interesting path. Like I've had conversations with people in my company that are like, is there a way we could automate some of your easier tasks? And I would explain that kind of process. And they're like, yeah, we can't do that. So, yeah, I mean, we're not there yet. And hopefully I can stave off the incoming, you know, job taking away AI wave that's on its way. But I'll try to fight that tide as much as I can for as long as I can.
How much has AI helped your job or enhanced or been a tool for what you're doing versus competition?
I don't work a lot with it, to be honest with you, at this point. I don't know if that'll change down the road. I think we're still trying to find practical applications for it within our business and within our sport. it's not AI, but I think the advanced way to look at different statistics and predictive outcomes is kind of like a cousin of it. You know, it's not, you know, hey, ChatGPT, write a report on, you know, greenhouse gases in the 80s or something for my, you know, whatever, like just, I'm making up a topic, but it's not as direct as that. But like the way you can take pieces of information and, you know, the, like I mentioned, the predictive element is so much stronger now than it used to be, where, you know, we're able to tell. One thing we like to do is with our manufacturing partners is we might be able to give you, okay, they might be interested in signing 4 or 5 really young players, and we might be able to identify who has, who can give them higher value because we predict that they're going to escalate in their careers. And you can figuratively be, the great example is Under Armour jumping on Jordan Spieth before he went crazy and became Jordan Spieth, right?
Wow.
So they see that example, and we can try to identify, all right, this number one player amateur in the world is going to cost you 5 times more than this guy, but we think this guy is potentially, you know, like the next Xander Schauffele, who didn't have a huge college career but became a great pro. Like, that's the kind of thing that we can do predictively that's really cool and really interesting and can help people out.
So all journalists have those, you know, those one or two stories that they broke that defined their career. And I wonder if there's a particular stat or correlation or some type of finding that you dug up and presented that sticks out in your mind as particularly revelatory or career defining in your case.
I think the first time I realized what Twitter and my Twitter account and presence could become and how impactful it could be was at the 2014 Masters. And I know I just mentioned Jordan Spieth. It was not the year Spieth won, but the year before, when it was Spieth, Jonas Blixt, and Bubba kind of duking it out on Sunday. And that Saturday night, I came up with a note that I think ran on SportsCenter, and then, you know, I shared the tweet online. So Jack Nicklaus became the youngest Masters champion. Forget that, I don't have the year off the top of my head. 17 years later, Seve broke that record. 17 years later, Tiger broke that record. 17 years later, Jordan Spieth had the potential to break Tiger's record. And so I worded it in a really, and phrased it in a way that was, you know, kind of like the trademark kind of way I do. And like within like 10 minutes, like the BBC retweeted it, like the news account. And then like, and then it was like mentioned like 8 times on Master Sunday by the broadcast team. And then I was like, okay, this is kind of the creative lane I can have that gives some value that's not there in the sport. And just seeing the wildfire reaction that it had. Like, I originally started the Twitter account because when I was really young, like 25, 26, I got to write a stats-based golf column for ESPN.com. And I was like, oh, I should probably have a Twitter account to promote it. And then it became a point where the Twitter account itself was a news-delivering avenue more so than just a promotional thing. And that was the tweet that kind of flipped the switch. And then a couple of times I've done, like for Tiger's birthday, I've done a thread of like the most stupid, ridiculous, inconceivable Tiger Woods stats. And that's a well that literally never runs out because you just find,
of which there are many. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, there's literally no end to it. I haven't even found all of them.
Yeah.
Like, those get the kind of reaction where people kind of really share, and it transcends just the golf world and goes to the whole sports landscape. But yeah, I think that one in 2014, the 17 years, Jack, Seve, Tiger. Of course, he didn't win, so it didn't make it perfect.
He didn't do it.
Yeah.
Do you think that tweet reached him? Do you think he saw that tweet?
Maybe. I don't know.
You didn't hear from him that it like it got to his head. He saw it and it ruined his chances.
I did not hear from Jordan. No, I did not.
He didn't show up at your house and say,
That would be some.
No, I did once yeah. when I think when Alabama, the year Tua started out with just crazy numbers. I looked up some Tua Tagovailoa stat, and JT responded and was like, please don't stop.
that's a really cool example. Man, the BBC. It's the BBC. They tweeted. They retweeted.
Yeah, it was some, you know, it's a colossal news outlet. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
You care about me? Like, what? What? Yeah. So, but I realized, like, okay, if it's a cool piece of information, it's timely, it's unique. It's detailed, it's relevant. People, the names in it resonate. it's the Masters, like all those things form together. It can be a really interesting piece of content. And like that kind of separating, it's not just data, it's storytelling. That kind of separating factor was something I recognized in that moment.
Well, Justin, let's hit a couple of our meat and potatoes questions. These are the questions that we ask all of our guests on the Group Golf Therapy Couch. We'll start out with a GGT house favorite. What are some of your favorite golf smells?
So you guys sent me these questions. I had to think about this one a little bit. You know, when you're on the ninth fairway, you're about to make the turn and it's around lunchtime, you're like 100 yards away and you can smell the grill in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
That is, that's the good stuff. Cause you're hungry at that point, you know, that's a fantastic smell. Also, when the grass is freshly cut in the morning, it's not too hot, but there's just like this one sweet spot in temperature where it's not an overwhelming aroma, but it's just a really cool smell. And it kind of makes me think of being a kid and going out and walking the golf course by myself, which is what I did a lot of summer days when it was a zillion degrees in Houston. But it just makes me think of that. So, those are probably two pretty easy ones, but yeah, I'd say those are two of my favorite smells.
If you could go back and play around with that younger version of Justin, what do you think that conversation would look like?
The first thing I would say is stop taking it so seriously. Stop getting so mad at yourself for every shot. You know, stop beating yourself up. And when you don't hit a good shot, like, dude, it's fine. You're going to be okay. Like, you know, this is not that serious. Cause I was like, I've always been super competitive. And I think when I was a kid, I was way too hard on myself when I didn't, you know, when I didn't succeed. So, that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I'd say is I've had a ton of back injuries and like figure out how to avoid those going forward, man. Like, cause it's going to really be a pain in the ass for a long time. So those are the primary things I say. Hey, ease up. Don't be so hard on yourself. And maybe we find a way to solve these back things before they start.
All right. Let's say you're teeing it up in local member guest at your, you know, local muni or something like that. You get a walk-up song for the first tee as you're, you know, they call your name to the first tee. What is the song that you would play to get you fired up as you drive, hopefully down the middle of the fairway on the first hole of that tournament?
The same song I use is walk-up music in high school baseball, which was Ambitions as a Rider by Tupac.
Justin, I don't... So... Drew, we just did a podcast with somebody.
Yeah.
We just did a podcast with somebody and they said the exact same song.
Oh man.
Not gonna lie.
That's crazy.
I'm a huge hip hop head, 90s and 2000s especially. I like some new stuff, but most of that's like my sweet spot. And I've been a massive Tupac fan my whole life. So I thought about it and I was that's probably the one I'd go to. Just because the intro, the daunting, kind of intimidating beginning to it. It's iconic.
Yeah.
Like, that's all you need. The thing with a good walk-up song, you got to think about the first like 15 seconds because that's all you're getting.
Exactly.
There's a lot of songs that are fantastic, but you got to wait till the build-up, right? So unless you can get them to cue it to the right spot.
Yeah, to the bridge. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. You got to have the right first 15, 20 seconds because that's what the people are getting.
Yeah, you're gaming the system.
Justin,
that's a smart answer.
Justin, we do have the entire playlist of every guest that's ever graced the couch of their walk-up song. So we will send you the Spotify link. And Ambitions of a Rider is now on there twice.
Twice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. Good.
Literally, it's at the top morning,
of my I have a Spotify playlist of mine that's leg day. Because that's just, you know, leg day is the worst day at the gym. So that's the one that kicks off leg day for me.
That's funny.
It's just funny because both people that have, they're both from Texas or both in Texas at the moment. So it must be a Texas thing.
Well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you think about it. But I mean, maybe it's just a certain era, certain vibe.
Could be. Okay, so Justin, Tupac was blasting, got you in the right headspace. All the data that you had collected on your own game helped you to the championship at that tournament, and they bring you back next year and they hold a meal in your honor, a champion's dinner, and you get to pick the menu. what is on Justin Ray's Champions Dinner menu?
So it's going to be Texas barbecue theme. I know that's probably, that could be a little bit cliche, but you know, we go, we got your smoked brisket, turkey, chicken legs, you know, potato salad. There's this awesome sriracha Brussels sprouts from this barbecue spot in Austin that I love. We're going all out. Bluebell ice cream, cold Shiner Bock beer, some good wine.
We're a Shiner Bock family.
That's probably the most important thing. When I was at my wedding, I had two requests, and my wife got to do everything else. I'm getting married in Jordan 11 Concords, black and white, and Shiner Bock will be everywhere. So everything else, you can do whatever you want. Those are the only requests I had, and I got them. So, you know,
that's amazing. But
yeah, no, we're definitely doing that. The way it was phrased to me was there was a like master's dinner or your last meal. To me, those are very different. The master's dinner, you're a host a little bit, right? You're trying to please everybody. Last meal is just pure hellion, just carnage. Awfulness. Yeah. Just whatever you want, because
gluttony.
It's all ending here in a little bit. So why not have some fun on your way out? And for that answer is all the chicken wings I could possibly eat, and like a dozen beers. That would be my, and then, you know, see you later. We're done. But if I'm trying to be a host and welcome everybody under the tent, we're all going to have some really good barbecue.
Well, both meals sound fantastic.
That's a great answer.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never thought about it like that, but I like that.
That's great.
That last meal ain't for anybody but me.
No. You're not hosting anything. You're the guest of honor in that situation. We have a segment on the show that we call Get a Grip, where we give our guests a full uninterrupted minute to rant about anything in the golf industry that is currently grinding their gears at the moment. So,
oh, geez. Nice week for that.
It's a hot week, but feel free to take some time if you need it, but we'll set the clock and let you spout off.
All right. We're better at this as a sport over the last 10 to 15 years, but the number one thing that has always driven me nuts about this game is the barrier of entry. We have to open as many doors as humanly possible and let people in and let people enjoy this thing. And we're getting better at it, but we're still not as good as we need to be. I think that is the biggest thing moving forward for the grow the game is such a tired phrase, right? But I think for the health and well-being of everything, bring everybody into the tent. The exclusionary country club bullshit is awful. We don't need any of it. I hate that aspect of the sport. I want everybody to come and enjoy it and have fun with it the way I always have throughout my life. And I think that is the biggest thing that has always grinded my gears, to use your phrase, Peter Griffin, about, you know, what's really bothered me over the years about it. And I really just wish we could do more to open the door up to everybody. This is an expensive ass sport to play, man. Clubs are expensive, the greens fees and everything. Anything we can find to make it more communal and have more people involved and have more fun, I'm all for that. So that's the thing that has always bugged me about the game.
Get a grip.
Yeah, we second that.
Motion seconded.
This is very enlightening. I think for myself, it's always interesting to take a peek behind the curtain on the sports broadcasts that we all tune into every single day, every single weekend, especially on major championships. And I think a lot of times people think that it's this like army of people that are doing all this, when in actuality, it might just be one person or two people, which is kind of mind blowing to think about. There's just some very dedicated people that have, really embraced the data but also the storytelling narrative and adding the context. So yeah, just thank you for what you do. We as the golf and the greater sports community appreciate your love of the game and your love of the storytelling behind some things that are just numbers on a page, but to you and to many more people, it's much more than that. So yeah, just thank you.
Thanks for the kind words, man. It's awesome. I appreciate it.
We hope we make it down to Dallas at some point. Maybe we can tee it up and get some Texas barbecue while we're down there.
For sure. Absolutely.
We'll be seeing your U.S. Open predictions come true next week. Xander Schauffele is going to bring it home.
Or not.
And I didn't say that. I didn't give you a call on who's winning. I just gave you a number. That's the thing, too, I love about the reaction of people. Like, if I tweet something out and they tell me either that, oh, you jinxed him, which, whatever. You said this was, I'm like, no, I didn't. I just gave you a number. Like,
this is fact.
It wasn't an opinion. Like, it's empirical fact. So, yeah.
Right. Anyway. But, yeah. Awesome. Well, to echo what Drew said, thanks for everything you do. And we look forward to seeing you in person, hopefully very soon.
For sure. Thanks for having me on, guys. I really enjoyed it.